Well, glad to get in. It's been an awesome time setting everything up. Welcome, Pasta, who's a core developer at Dash and has a really unique background that I think will connect really well with our grassroots advocacy and goal-oriented efforts. How's your everything going for you, Pasta? Everything working well?
It's pretty busy right now. Dash is getting ready to release version 21 of Dash Core, and with it is coming the Dash platform, Dash Evolution Genesis chain. This is a project that has been kind of in the works for, or at least conceptually in the works for, say, maybe almost 5 years now. So there's been a lot of change in who's been managing that project over time, and it moved from JavaScript to Rust. It's taken forever, but we're finally deploying it to mainnet this coming 29th. So a lot of stuff to kind of wrap up in the next couple of days and get kind of these releases built and get them ready to be published on the 29th. So definitely a busy time, but exciting.
Wow, that is exciting and a lot behind it for sure. What's it like working on the core side of things with the protocol for that update that's coming next week? How does it work, making sure everyone's on the same page with security, with testing the releases, and then the actual speed of development?
So that's something where obviously there's a lot of difference depending on the maturity of your product. And so in Dash, we have a couple of different teams. I'm kind of the lead developer on the core dev team, but there's also the platform team, there are mobile teams, stuff like that. The core team is probably the stablest, the most robust. That doesn't mean we're not working on stuff and we're not delivering new features, but we are more conservative about how we get to those new features. We want to make sure we have, a nice long testing period. We dot all our I's and cross all our T's because people are using this network every day. And, if something bad happens and it goes down, that's a big problem. And, it means people are not able to send their money around. And that's obviously something we want to avoid. On the other hand, the platform team, right, they are moving towards their first release. So they are, becoming more and more stable now, but they can historically basically do whatever they want. If they want to completely wipe the network and redeploy, it's fine. It's a testing network. No one's using it. So now that it is becoming ready for production, they're having to slow down a little bit. But this release that we're coming out with is kind of inspired in some ways. I believe it was the Thorchain Chaos Net, I think is what they called it, where the platform team is acknowledging like this is a early version. And so while we've done everything we can to make sure it is secure and stable and will do fine, it's kind of expected that something is going to break at some point, and the network will go down for hours or days at end. If it doesn't, that's the goal. That's amazing. But it's expected for the platform chain to have some kind of issue as it's getting rolled out. So you definitely see, a lot of disparity depending on what your product is and how mature it is and how important it is that it has to stay online. And so that's kind of something that we see with Bitcoin nowadays is they basically do nothing because they have to be sure that, everything works. And so the easiest way to make sure everything works is, well, don't change stuff in a breaking way, especially. So, yeah, it is an interesting question. You definitely have to measure how aggressive you can be depending on what your product is and your requirements there.
Wow, that's very insightful, Pasta, and definitely something I don't think a lot of people realize. You spoke on Bitcoin and just blockchains in general, that there actually is a lot of work that goes on a continual basis to make sure that these solutions stay on point. I know you could talk on that, and I know you've also worked and contributed to Bitcoin on what it's like there and how that working, how does that working process, I mean, how does it get coordinated at all?
Obviously in Bitcoin and in Dash, the biggest spot of coordination is on the GitHub. And some people worry about like centralization around GitHub. That's really not a concern. anyone that knows kind of how Git works, every single person who works on the repository has a copy on their local machine. And so even if GitHub disappeared tomorrow, the only thing that would potentially be problematic is stuff like your GitHub issues, where you're figuring out, you know, what features you want to be working on in that kind of coordination. And you could easily move over to something like GitLab, or you can even run your own instance of GitLab. But yeah, the biggest source of coordination is going to be your GitHub, your issue tracker, and your, you know, merge request, pull request tracker. That's where the vast majority of your communication should be. And, you know, I think that's really valuable, because it's kind of like email. It's asynchronous. It is, you know, anyone can go on there anytime. There's a history of all of it. It's kind of like a good old fashioned, you know, Linux mailing list. There is also like a Bitcoin dev mailing list, very similar to like the Linux mailing lists. I think actually it might be hosted by the Linux Foundation. I'm not positive about that. And so that is where you're going to get more of your high level conceptual ideas and discussions. So early days on a BIP, or Bitcoin Improvement Proposal, is generally on, at least in the Bitcoin ecosystem, on the mailing list. Sometimes that could be in, you know, a forum, or, you know, Bitcoin Talk was big in the past, the Dash forum or something like that. That's normally where you get that high level conceptual discussion. And then once some of the details are getting nailed down for that, then you'll move over to something like a improvement proposal repository. Mm-hmm. And so in Bitcoin, that's the Bitcoin Improvement Proposals, also called BIPs. Dash is their own that they call DIPs. And so that's where you're going to actually, you know, take time and write down a specification for this new feature or whatever. Generally, you only do that if it's something that affects the entire ecosystem. So, you know, one of the major ones happening right now in the Bitcoin ecosystem is BIP 324. That is a standard for peer-to-peer encryption. And it's basically like HTTPS for Bitcoin nodes, which is really, really valuable. But right, that starts out as a BIP. You write the paper, you specify, okay, these are the algorithms we're going to use for encryption. This is how the protocol is going to work. And then you publish that BIP. People, you know, review it. They conceptually say, yeah, this makes sense, or it doesn't, for these reasons. And then at some point, that BIP gets merged into the BIP repository. And that doesn't mean it's like official, or it's like going to be adopted by actual projects that implement code. It just means that, yes, this is a technical specification that from a, like, specification point of view makes sense. Like, someone could look at this document and build something from it. And so there are a bunch of BIPs in the Bitcoin ecosystem that started out and then never got implemented. BIP 324 actually had a predecessor. I think it was BIP 151. That was the exact same idea. It was, you know, encryption between peers for your P2P traffic. And for that, it ended up dying. Whether there just wasn't a developer that really wanted to spend time and implement it, I don't remember. There might have been a couple of issues with the way that BIP was designed. But a lot of BIPs end up dying and don't get implemented. So that's where your like technical specifications get hashed out and you get that figured out. Uh-huh. And then you go back to GitHub and you actually implement it. So otherwise, there is some extra coordination. Generally, like in my team, we have a weekly meeting where we go over, you know, what we've worked on, what we're going to be working on next week, if we have any blockers, stuff like that. Kind of like a stand-up, but my team doesn't like to have meetings every day, and I'm happy about that. So we just have that once a week. Bitcoin also has, I forget what they call it, but they have a, can't remember if it's once weekly or once every 2 weeks or something like that. They have a kind of meeting on the Bitcoin Dev IRC channel where people get together and they talk about what they've been working on and any issues that they've been having. So, you know, if you're trying to get a pull request merged into Bitcoin, that can sometimes be a good spot to go to try to find people to review your pull request. As projects get bigger and bigger, maintainer time becomes one of your most valuable assets. For
my project right now, we don't get a absolute ton of external contributions. And so it's relatively easy for me to stay on top of it and, you know, provide good review and merge it in or whatever. In Bitcoin, they get a lot of external contributors. So you want to try to make sure, you know, that you explain as much as you can in your initial post, and you make stuff as simple as possible. So yeah, a lot of different avenues of coordination depending on what exactly it is that you're trying to do at any time. But yeah, I hope that gave some insight there.
So it sounds like you've sort of seen both sides of the spectrum, where you're working with your own group at the Dash Core company that has a agenda and is everyone sort of coordinated through a universal system on that side. And then on the other end of the spectrum, if I'm hearing this right, there's the Bitcoin side where there really is no guiding organization or anyone organizing the labor efforts, but instead it's just people sort of volunteering and putting in their time and efforts to contribute to the project. Is that right, Pasta?
I think that is mostly fair to say. There are, from my understanding, full-time developers that do work on Bitcoin Core. And so they might have a much higher level of kind of communication, and you know, they might have some meeting that they have every couple of days or every week that is just, you know, the set of developers that is basically working full time on Bitcoin. A lot of those people are actually like employed or paid by you know, Blockstream, or like, I don't remember some of the organizations, but think of, you know, big exchanges, maybe a Kraken or a Coinbase type example. A lot of those companies will fund developers because they want to make sure, obviously, development continues. So they might have a higher level of coordination and making sure that people are working on stuff, but I don't have any insight into that.
Well, it almost seems to get to a little bit of your background as we talk about the open coding process. Could you tell us maybe a little bit about, you know, some people call Bitcoin the ultimate bug bounty program, and to your background, how did you really get into this Web3 development in the first place, Pasta?
Yeah, I mean, the really early days is kind of, to your point, is I ended up finding a couple of bugs or conceptual kind of issues in a system in Dash, and I ended up submitting a couple of bug bounties, and I kind of got into the project through that. So yeah, I mean, from I don't know if there is a like official bug bounty project for Bitcoin, but obviously, you know, if you were to find a way to, you know, potentially do something malicious inside the Bitcoin ecosystem, right, there's a lot of rewards there, so to speak. Yeah, I guess that's where kind of you could call it the ultimate bug bounty. But Dash actually had a formal bug bounty process where you could just submit an issue, and if it was significant enough and, you know, novel, or, yeah, I guess significant enough and novel are good ways to describe it, you could get a reward. So that's how I originally kind of got into actual development on Dash.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about that kind of centralized team working on the core protocol? I know Dash uses, if I understand, the MIT license. What's it like doing that development with a transparent oversight process?
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, Dash Core Group is the primary group that does development on Dash Core, but obviously we're not the only people that ever contribute to it. There are forks of Dash Core that have contributed back fixes or improvements. And so that is a big thing in any kind of this open source development is, and I even do this to a degree, the majority of my contributions to Bitcoin Core, and there aren't a lot of them, there may be a handful, but the majority of my contributions to Bitcoin Core have been something where I've looked at the Dash project and I've been like, oh, it would be really nice if we had this improvement or something like that. And so one of the first things I'll try to do is, if it's easy enough, I will PR it to Bitcoin, and that way I'm getting some of their input, and also they get that improvement if they end up wanting it and merging it in, and it's not just my project. So
That is, but that also comes back to my previous point of, right, maintainer time is very scarce, but also developer time is kind of scarce. And so over time, I have contributed less and less to Bitcoin Core because it is a lot of overhead in order to actually get something merged in. And I can't fault the Bitcoin maintainers. They are doing so much stuff and so much work. But it can be difficult at times to get someone to actually review your pull request. And the harder it is for that kind of process to happen, the less likely you are to get pull requests from external people. So I feel like I didn't really answer your question. Do you want to repeat it if I didn't?
Well, I saw Chives, I think, raised his hand. So if you want, anyone wants to come on, feel free to hit the button.
Well, it's a bit of a departure from what, you know, from what you were just speaking about, but I was curious just to cut in because I wanted to ask just a bit more about, you know, you mentioned how you organize when it comes to GitHub as a platform for people to contribute what they're working on, the ways that you work with your team members about that, and how you only have maybe a small number of active contributors, perhaps, compared to the large number of people that are using Dash day to day as, you know, clients or people familiar with protocol and invested in your work. So I was curious to know that you mentioned you meet weekly. How is that? Do you guys record that? Do you guys try to share that with the community? Are people paying attention to what you're working on? Or is it just the GitHub updates that these individual users are making that people, like, do people parse that together themselves? I was just curious what you do for community engagement on that front. Yeah. Or if people are even interested, because I know developing and participating are completely different realms sometimes.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So we have, let's see. So in addition to the weekly meeting that I have within my team, Dash Core Group also does every other week what is called a sprint review. My team doesn't actually use sprints, but it's still called a sprint review because some of the other teams do use sprints. And so every 2 weeks, we have a public call. It's about an hour long, and each of the teams kind of goes over some of the highlights of what they accomplished in the last 2 weeks. We also have like a newsletter that gets sent out every maybe month or so that, again, goes over some of the high levels of stuff that is done. A lot of times, especially in a more mature project like Dash, there's not a lot that is super interesting on a biweekly basis, or even, you know, more frequently than that. And so a lot of times it can get kind of mundane to most people if they're not actually in the development of it. A lot of what at least my team does on a regular basis is, you know, Bitcoin backports, as we are a fork of Bitcoin. As Bitcoin makes improvements, we pull those improvements into our own repositories. And so that is a large amount of work that gets done continuously, but isn't very interesting. Sometimes there's super interesting backports that we do highlight, but the majority of the time it's just mundane code refactoring that happens. So it's definitely a lot easier to communicate what is going on when there's stuff that's really interesting to a user-facing perspective. And so that's where younger projects kind of have an advantage because they're able to move faster and break stuff. And so they're able to every week or every 2 weeks talk about really interesting features to end users. Yeah. Did that answer that? Did you have anything else on that kind of question?
Well, I appreciate your kind of, you know, bulking that out a little bit as far as how you engage with the community, but perhaps even more accurately to your answer, you know, what kind of engagement you're expecting in the first place. And how it's important, I suppose, to recognize that some things do end up being mundane at a certain point. So that's important to remember, I suppose. Can't expect everyone to have the same level of, you know, direct involvement naturally. That's perfect. Thank you for that. I guess the only other thing I was curious about is if you use any other supplemental communication platforms or, I mean, you mentioned kind of the asynchronous public nature of GitHub communication, which I love as well. But do you find that there are items lacking when you're trying to do team management tasks. I'm just curious for a bit of that back-end leadership stuff as well.
Yeah, so generally GitHub issues and GitHub projects have done a pretty good job, in my opinion, at providing that kind of coordination and planning. It's probably not as advanced of a tool as something like Jira, but for myself, who's not really like a scrum master or anything, it works really well to give you that enhanced productivity and visibility into what your team members are doing, but not so much that you need kind of a dedicated person managing it. So yeah, definitely GitHub issues, GitHub projects. We also internally do have a private GitHub repo that doesn't have any code actually, but we do keep some issues there that are just maybe not quite like, they're not really on the roadmap or anything. Maybe they're not really as fleshed out as we would like them to be kind of publicly more visible. And so probably about like, I don't know, there's a solid split of our issues that we're tracking that are in either the public set of issues or the set of issues that are really only for the team. Sometimes there's just stuff that doesn't really make sense to be super public yet. So.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Pasta, could you tell us a little more about any of the private repos? So are those mostly like security bugs that are getting taken care of, or are there other things that are sort of done out of the public light on the GitHub side or anywhere else?
Yeah. So generally the only stuff that is over there is, well, let's see, maybe I'll look at some of them and try to get some inspiration. Sometimes it's just easier to, you know, write down all of your thoughts if you're not worried about, you know, what, you know, someone externally might think of how you're writing it down. Uh-huh. Or, you know, there's some stuff where there's maybe a planning stage that it might be a significant enough feature where we would want community approval before we do it, but we want to have a spot to kind of figure out what it would look like technically a little bit before we actually go to the community and say, hey, do you want us to do this thing? So that we can actually provide them more valuable information at that point. The other component, I guess, is sometimes we will put stuff in the private issues repo that is more questionable whether it's going to get done at any point in the near future or whether it should get done. That way we're able to kind of keep it on our backlog and we're able to track it and decide over time if we want to kind of add it to the roadmap, but we're not having it publicly as an issue and then someone comes along and looks at it and is like, that's an interesting issue, I want to create a pull request that does it, and then they spend, you know, a couple of days implementing the thing, and then we have to tell them, actually, we can't merge that in right now because X, Y, and Z, you know? So it's a lot of just like mundane stuff that honestly probably could be public now that I'm looking at it. One of the annoying parts with GitHub projects and GitHub issues is you're able to transfer issues, but between repositories, but you can never transfer an issue from a private repository to a public repository. And so over time, there has been stuff where it started out in kind of as a private issue because we just didn't have any, we weren't going to implement it immediately or, you know, whatever I talked about previously. There was some reason that we wanted to create it here. And then it got to a stage where it could be in the public issues just fine, but we just can't transfer it and we didn't want to recreate it. So yeah, there's really not a ton of stuff that's super interesting over here, but yeah, you could also track any kind of like security potentially vulnerable stuff there, but I would probably prefer something like Keybase and keeping it in properly encrypted communications if it's really security critical. But yeah.
Wow. Well, it seems like it touches on a little bit of how a lot of the work has a sort of aspect of global collaboration in it. Do you see a similar sort of people working on things in the private and then bringing it to the network? Maybe like with contributions like introducing opcodes. Could you talk to us a little on what that's like for you?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, we had a project a little while ago. I can't remember what it was that they actually ended up implementing. I think it, well, so there's one, I think, setup that I think Bitcoin Cash originally implemented, and it basically changes the way that you can sign. Oh, it includes the amount in the signature. And so you would need different opcodes for it, but it makes hardware wallet signing so much easier because right now a hardware wallet, at least in Dash, needs the previous transactions in order to validate the amounts because the amounts are not signed, only the previous, UTXO hash is signed. And so the hardware wallet has to request all of these transactions. It has to validate all of these transactions. It has to parse them, it has to add everything up. And for a really lightweight, SoC like a hardware wallet, that can take a long time. So when you're creating giant transactions, that can take a while. Yeah, so that kind of contribution that comes from kind of an external source, you definitely you end up at least in a kind of Dash system where most of our contributions come from within the team. You end up slowing down a little bit for those kind of external communication, for those external requests. You want to, of course, make sure that everything is done correctly and there's proper testing and everything like that, because they are generally, if they're external, they probably don't know your processes as well. They don't know kind of the style or everything like that. You do want to slow down and make sure everything is done correctly. But generally, it just becomes a question of, okay, do we need a dip for this? Is it, changing what happens in the ecosystem-wide setup? And in that case, before merging it in, you would want to ask them to write a improvement proposal and get that merged into the improvement proposal project first. And then once that's done, assuming it aligns with kind of your goals for the project, in Dash, if it doesn't, we have a governance system where, while the governance system, I guess, couldn't directly tell Dash Core Group what to do, it does end up paying our paychecks. And so we have a strong incentive to follow what the network tells us to do. And so if a project came to us and said, hey, we want to, add this opcode or do this thing, and we said, no, we don't think that makes sense for these reasons. If they ended up going to the network and kind of getting the network to agree with them, well, we wouldn't be forced, so to speak, but we would potentially, you don't normally want to say no to your boss, and in this case, or whoever writes your paycheck, and in this case, that is the governance system and the network as a whole. So we would have a strong incentive to actually do what they direct us to.
Well, love
I love that. I love that process
that.
That you call the decentralized system of governance of users your boss. I mean, even beyond the paycheck aspect, that is something which I'm sure the that has fluctuated probably with time and as the network has become more mature. But I've listened to some appearances of yours from years ago, and it seems like that kind of reverence for community was always there. So I just really appreciate that kind of framework when you approach these things.
Yeah, it's definitely really important to kind of recognize that. Now, there's sometimes where, there might be one thing or another where a developer would say, no, I'm not going to do that, even though, you really, you clearly, you the network disagrees with you. There might be those kind of deal breakers for different people, but there's definitely large deference, I would say, from my perspective. And there is a large amount of deference the other way. I think if someone came to the network and said, I think we should do this thing, and I publicly posted and said, here are all the reasons that I think it's a bad idea, a lot of people would, you know, give deference to me, but ultimately it is the network and the community that is actually voting on it and making that decision, even if they do kind of value my opinion pretty highly.
Well, that's something that, you know, that's a cachet which you've developed over a period of years of contributions, would be my outsider's perspective on that, not having seen any such discussions, but it makes good sense that, you know, people attribute these sorts of values and, you know, to community figures over periods of time. I think that's something that is a double-edged sword. I mean, sometimes it'd be better for ideas to live and die based on their own merits rather than those who posit them. But, you know, we're not perfect automatons in that way.
Yes, for sure.
Well, that touches on Dash's fairly unique governance system on top of the proof of work consensus. Could you tap on that? Just explain it for anyone who's not familiar, Pasta.
Yeah, so I think Dash was at least arguably the first like DAO. Yeah. I don't know if we had that kind of terminology at the time, but very early on in the project, masternodes were introduced, which are collateralized nodes. And I don't love the term masternodes, but it's what we've got and it's fine. Masternodes have to hold 1,000 dash, and for holding that 1,000 dash, they get to run a server that has to provide services to the network. So, right, a lot of the issues with Bitcoin scaling is, we don't want it to be too expensive to run a node. In a lot of ways, Dash solves that by paying the people that run these nodes. And so by holding that 1,000 Dash, you get a you get part of the block reward. You also get voting privileges, and you also have to run a node that provides services to the network. And those masternodes collectively, they end up forming what we call long-living masternode quorums. And those long-living masternode quorums basically serve as the basis for what is, in a sense, kind of a proof-of-stake system on top of the proof-of-work system. Historically, Dash does not at all use the term proof-of-stake, but if you look at it from a technical perspective, it is very similar. And so every block or transaction that is published to the network basically gets sent to a quorum, and that quorum as a whole will vote on it. And so they're basically voting on if it was first seen, and it doesn't conflict with any other blocks or transactions that it has. And they will vote on it, and that provides what is called instant send and chain locks. And so, you know, in Bitcoin, you might have to wait 6 confirmations to get a kind of relatively rough guarantee that something is going to be in the blockchain forever. In Dash, if you send a transaction, you get an instant send lock. And what that tells you is, okay, these 4,000 or 5,000 masternodes, which constitute the majority of kind of the actual peer-to-peer network, are guaranteeing, and everyone else that is following by the rules, by this instant send lock, they guarantee that no transaction that conflicts with it will be mined into a valid block. And if a miner does mine a block that conflicts with this instant send lock, everyone else is going to reject it. And so it gives you really good guarantees within just, in my testing, it's been about 1.4 seconds. In about 1.4 seconds, you can know with very good certainty that that transaction is going to be mined into a block at some point. And then there's an even higher level of kind of security, which is chain locks. And so on every single block, basically the same process happens. It goes to a much bigger quorum. And once the vast majority of that quorum agrees that, yes, this was the first block that we've seen, it's a valid block, it is the proper tip, a message is produced called a chain lock signature. The rest of the network gets that. And now there is no possibility for a reorganization. That block cannot become an orphan. That is part of the chain. And it's not possible to have multiple conflicting chain locks because, obviously, you know, a node will never vote for 2 different blocks to be the proper tip. Every masternode will only vote for 1 block to be a proper tip, and you need the vast majority of a quorum. So, yeah. All right. I think that kind of... Okay, so we talked about governance a little bit, masternodes, quorums, instant send. But yeah, so the governance system does pay a lot of other projects besides just Dash Core Group. Dash Core Group nowadays is, in all effects, just a development group. It used to have a little bit of like regulatory outreach or marketing or that kind of thing. Uh-huh. Over time, those parts of the company have shrunk and now are nearly non-existent, if not non-existent. And now Dash Core Group is just development. And so we work on, you know, Dash Core itself, Dash Platform, like I talked about, a couple of the mobile apps. And then there are some other projects which are also funded by the DAO, but have different leadership, everything like that. And they do, you know, some marketing or different outreach or whatever different project. There is what is called the Dash Incubator, which is a organization that basically will create little bounties for projects that they want to get done. And then anyone can come into the Dash Incubator and say, this is an interesting project, I'd like to work on it. And after they complete that project, they get kind of the bounty reward in Dash. And so they get compensated for kind of the work that they're doing, but it's a very low commitment kind of thing. And of course, there is kind of coordination between these different teams that are funded by the governance system, by the DAO. But yeah, I covered a lot there. Any questions on any of that stuff?
Oh, that's really interesting, Pasta. On that last part, I know you also in the past co-founded Dash Boost when it was active and were trying to fund innovation. Could you talk a little bit on how you do that? It seems like you have a really unique perspective because you have the decentralized funding from the network, and then you have sort of a centralized effort to put it into a project. Am I on the right track there?
Yeah, that is a pretty good way to put it. So Dash Boost at the time was envisioned as basically a mini treasury. One of the big issues was the cost to submit a proposal in dollars was something like $5,000. And so if you wanted to do a little project, if you wanted to, you know, if you wanted to create a wallet in JavaScript for Dash or something like that, maybe that'll take you a couple of weeks. There are some good Bitcoin libraries you can use, something like that. Maybe it takes you a couple of weeks and you want, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 for it. Well, the fee to simply submit a proposal was $5,000. And so it was very difficult for small projects to try to kind of break into the governance system and start getting paid by them. And so the idea behind Dash Boost was it would be basically the governance system, but on a smaller scale. And so you could submit a proposal for about one fifth the cost as it was on the actual governance system. Dash Boost put in a proposal itself to the governance system to get paid out a certain amount of Dash. And then whatever we got from the treasury system, we distributed to these smaller projects that got voted on by, you know, the same people that hold Dash. Over time, Dash Core Group has made changes where the cost to submit a proposal is significantly lower. And so now the cost to submit a proposal is really only in the realm of like $30 to $50. And so what we found is that is a good enough middle ground where it is enough to prevent like blatant spam, but pretty much anyone with an idea can submit a proposal. And if people like it enough and vote for you, you can get funding from the network as well. Yeah, so that was the whole idea with Dash Boost. It was just making the governance system more accessible to smaller projects. Nowadays, it doesn't really have a role because we've kind of dealt with that from a protocol level. Yeah.
You've dealt with it at a protocol level, Pasta?
Yeah. So, I mean, governance is part of the protocol. Every month, I forget, 12,000, 13,000 blocks, something like that. There's a super block, and that is
the block that pays out all of these governance proposals, if they are passing, if they have the votes. So, right, over time, in the protocol, we changed the fee that was required to submit a proposal. And this whole governance system is completely decentralized. Like, there is no one managing it or anything like that. Anyone can submit a proposal just using Dash Core if they have some Dash. There's no authority that can, you know, remove a proposal or anything like that. It's just masternodes can vote for or against it. And if enough people vote for it, then you get funded.
Would you describe, if you don't mind, that funding process? I'm wondering, is it something where, let's say I have a bunch of interest or passion for some specific proposal. Is there personal funding from private parties, or is it more of a governance-focused thing where there's a fund which can fund, you know, the things that went through the democratic process? Is it both? Is there a third thing? I'm just curious to know more about that, because that's really terrific what you guys have built there.
Yeah, so there's nothing stopping someone from donating to a proposal directly, but generally it doesn't happen a lot. That is, right, one of the big benefits of having a governance system is you don't necessarily need to donate to individual projects, because as a community, you're deciding we're going to collectively donate to kind of this project, right? Whenever you fund a project in the governance system, while there is a cap to it, you can kind of think of it as just minting new coins. And so every time you fund a project, you are basically devaluing your coins just a little bit. And you know, it requires the approval of it's a slightly weird voting system, but in net effect, it requires the approval of between 2/3 and 3/4 of, the people voting, sometimes even higher if there aren't that many people voting. But you need a high level of agreement within people to actually fund that project. But then it's kind of like everyone is giving them a donation. In Monero and in Bitcoin, you see a lot of donations from individuals or from companies. In Dash, you don't really see that as much because we have this system to proactively fund people.
And from what you've seen, do you think that works better?
It definitely provides a lot better stability. While there is instability because it relies on the price of Dash, right? And in a sense, it kind of creates this negative price pressure where people get funded by the DAO and then, you know, they need to use those funds to survive. And so a lot of those funds end up getting sold. But it does remove a lot of the kind of pressure of trying to get donations or something like that, while still providing kind of a really good amount of accountability.
And not to mention, you know, the continued focus on community development, not just as community, but in terms of additional resources, which is really an incredible thing. You'd mentioned, I guess, though, that a little while ago that there's not too much in terms of community contribution. Does that extend out to, you know, this whole this bounty framework as well, or is that kind of insulated from those kind of pushes?
Yeah, so the bounty system is a part of the Dash incubator. And so you can basically Google that and go to their website and take a look at kind of the bounties that they have available. The Dash Incubator is itself a governance-funded, a DFO, a DAO-funded organization. And so the incubator gets their money from the governance system. They basically put in a proposal, more or less, every month, and they get money from the treasury. And then over time, through these grants, I guess, through these I forget the term I used, but through these projects that they put up, through these bounties, they give out that money over time that they got in from the treasury. So,
And when they submit their bid to the network DAO, is that all stored on chain?
So it is not. It is, but it isn't. So, there is a component that is stored on chain that says this is basically the amount that I'm requesting, this is the address that I'm requesting it to, and this is a link to some web page that has more information about what I'm trying to do. And so for the vast majority of projects, that link goes to a spot on what is called Dash Central, dashcentral.org. And so you can go there and look at all of the budget proposals that are that went to the network in this past month. And in fact, they're going to get paid out in about an hour or two. And so you can take a look at all of the projects here. You can look at kind of the Dash Core funding, the different Dash Incubator funding, a couple of the different other projects that got funding, including like some marketing stuff. All of that information, that supplemental, like actual, the information of the actual proposal itself is not stored on chain, but is accessible through these third party websites like Dash Central. Over time, we do want to move this metadata basically over onto what is called Dash Platform, like I talked about earlier, and is releasing in like 5 days or so on the 29th. We want to move a lot of this data that is historically not on chain to be on the platform chain so that it is accessible forever, and we get better kind of strong guarantees in Dash Core. One of the problems from like a very technical perspective mm-hmm. of the governance system is that it's kind of a soft consensus mechanism. It is kind of just like super blocks are valid because the rest of the network agrees that the super block is valid. Over time, we would like to get it where we actually have a hard consensus, like here is a signature, here's an aggregate signature from all of the master nodes that proves that, you know, this super block is valid. So like right now, light nodes cannot really validate super blocks. They can validate that it doesn't exceed the amount that it is able to pay, but SPV nodes, mobile clients, stuff like that cannot validate that like a specific proposal that got paid was supposed to get paid. But yeah, so that's just more of a like technical kind of thing that we want to move away from over time. That doesn't really affect the user experience at all. It just would be better from an actual architectural point of view. So,
wow, it seems like you're doing a lot of work to distribute that trust as much as you can. And I heard you say in a past interview, you're trying to make sure no one can exploit it or game the system. Have you seen a lot of that?
So especially in like the 2018, I guess, bull run kind of time frame, there were one of the problems with the way that the governance system is written is, or at least not necessarily the way that it's written, but the way the community uses it is more of a prepayment for future activities. It's not a payment for what has been accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can be hard at times. A team might come in, they might propose something, they might get some funding, and then not actually be able to accomplish what they said they were going to do. And so over time, that has kind of, just by kind of community agreement, almost centralized the governance system a little bit more than really we would like. And so the incubator does a good job here of giving opportunities for kind of new people to come into the ecosystem and do stuff and get paid. But right now it's really hard for someone who isn't known by people in the Dash ecosystem to end up getting a proposal passed. People are very hesitant because we've had negative experiences in the past where a project isn't really able to accomplish what they say they're going to. And we kind of, you know, lose out on that. That funding that we gave them. So potentially in the future, as the governance system moves over to Dash Platform, we can implement more advanced structures where we say basically, you know, this is an amount you're going to get up front, and we're committing to giving you this amount, but only if enough masternodes agree that you basically did what you said you were going to do. So that's definitely kind of a pitfall. That's something you want to try to avoid, and that's something we're going to be working to kind of evolve away from.
Right. That makes sense. So it's hard to validate the people behind it. Has anyone ever tried to do something big and then come back and ask for payment retrospectively?
No, not really. Yeah, not really. A lot of it is always prepayment. That is something the community could, you know, kind of change, and they could tell people like, hey, you should do this, and then we, you know, can vote on it after you've actually done the thing. But a lot of people who are trying to do something want some kind of guarantee that they're actually going to get paid for what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very concerning if you can't get a, like, yes signal from the community that, yes, they want that thing. You know, you want confirmation that you're going to get paid before you actually spend a bunch of time doing it. So, yeah.
And I imagine that folks would have to be quite specific about what exactly it is that they're proposing that they do. Otherwise, you might run into scenarios where, you know, an individual believes they've fulfilled their terms of the agreement, but, you know, perhaps the majority of voting nodes don't agree that that it has gone far enough or is a sufficient solution to the problem initially posited, and so on.
Yeah. Over time, especially in kind of the middle phases of that 2018 bull run, there were a couple of organizations within the kind of Dash ecosystem that stood up projects to basically act as a middleman to outline some kind of, you know, memorandum of understanding or otherwise, you know, create a specification for what they're going to do. And then the treasury system would fund that middleman, and the actual end person would only receive kind of funding over time as they actually accomplish what they agreed on. The problem was is that was centralized, and it introduces kind of regulatory risk. It introduces, you know, legal risk of if, you know, that middleman is now potentially liable to get sued if they say, no, you didn't do what you said you were going to do. We're not going to pay you. They could get sued by the person who thought they were going to get paid. So those kind of projects ended up kind of phasing away. And so being able to do it in a decentralized way where obviously, you know, you can't really sue the DAO, creating it in a decentralized way where maybe a proposal passes when you get 2/3 yes vote. And, you know, that gives you a good guarantee that you will be funded. But then you have to come back to the network a month later and say, OK, here's what I did. And then maybe you need a lower threshold. Maybe you only need, you know, a 50% majority of people saying, yes, they did what they said they were going to do. And then you get the rest of your funds. There are ways to solve it. It just needs some thought. You want to make sure you're avoiding some of these pitfalls.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, escrows have been used for thousands of years. So, you know, it's a big undertaking, and it's going to take, you know, there are going to be some falls and some getting back ups again. And the idea is, you know, this graduated release of funds, you know, seems elegant on the face. Yeah, so that's already great thinking. I'm sure there's other good ideas about how to best address the problem.
Yeah.
On that note, Pasta, could you tell us just a little on what a DAO means to you?
Yeah, so I mean, a DAO is a decentralized autonomous organization. So right, it's something that, you know, does not have, I mean, it's, you know, relatively self-explanatory from kind of just the term itself, but it does have some more complicated aspects to it, right? So right, it should be decentralized. There should be no gatekeepers in the system, right? And so in the Dash DAO system, I mean, you could say that needing 1,000 Dash is a kind of gatekeeper, but that's... you know, not a centralized person or anyone telling you that you can't join. It's just you haven't met the requirement. As soon as you have that requirement, right, there's nothing that anyone can do to stop you from joining the DAO and getting a vote. Right, it needs to be self-actuating, right? The system should always kind of continue chugging along, even if kind of no one does anything. In Dash, no one would get paid if anyone did anything.
If no one submitted any votes or any proposals, right, you wouldn't get paid. But right, there's nothing that any single person needs to do in order for the system to keep moving. If enough people vote yes, it continues. So that kind of satisfies the autonomous part. And then obviously organization, right, it needs to be something that you can point at and say, look, that is like a concept, that is a group of things working together. So yeah, any way that you can take an action in a decentralized way is probably a DAO, if there are like a lot of people kind of working together towards it. It doesn't necessarily have to be funding related. It could be, you could have a kind of DAO for deciding if a network is going to upgrade or not, or something like that. Yeah.
Great. Well, on that note of, I get that there's this decentralized Dash network, and then there's also this Dash core group. And as I understand, feel free to jump in, you sort of worked your way from the bug bounty up to getting an internship and then joined the actual Dash company itself and worked your way up the development path there, building out the network infrastructure. Could you tell us a little bit about what that was like, how the work works? I know they had I understand that there were places in like Hong Kong, Thailand, and Arizona where everyone came together to work. What was that like in the whole ecosystem?
Yeah, so yeah, like you alluded to, I started out with basically the Dash Boost project was one of the early things that I did in my involvement with Dash. Over time, I got into some of the bug bounties. This was kind of towards the end of Dash Boost really being a viable project. So we kind of ramped down Dash Boost, and I moved kind of more into like the Dash core development. So at that point, people kind of knew me a little bit, but not a ton. And I had sent out a email to basically the CTO at the time of Dash Core, and they had never like had an intern or anything like that, but I was really interested in the project. I wanted to kind of work on it. I was pretty new to C++ development. I had been doing some coding before that, but I joined the team and started basically doing Bitcoin backports. Bitcoin backports are not a lot of fun. They're a lot of just kind of grunt work and, you know, resolving conflicts in Git and then making sure stuff compiles. Really isn't a lot of fun, but it's very necessary. And so that's what kind of a lot of more junior kind of members of the team will end up doing for a little while. It is really valuable to help get to know the code base, get to know some of the history. It takes you all over the code base. You see everything from the tests to, you know, how the actual consensus works to how sending transactions work. You know, you get well-rounded by doing backports, but it's not necessarily fun. I started there, and over time, as kind of people left, I took up just more and more responsibilities within the team. As kind of there was just churn over time, I took on more responsibilities. At this point, I think my technical title is like the principal developer of the core team. So probably about half of my job is like actual coding, and the rest of it is kind of maintainership and kind of project management. So making sure, you know, the rest of my team knows what they're doing, they're not being blocked. I review basically every pull request into the repo. So I handle a lot of stuff related to releases. Yeah, that was kind of the path. Was there anything else specifically on that you wanted me to touch on?
So I'd see reviewing pull requests, from what I can tell, is a big part of the responsibility, if I understand correctly. Could you tell us a little more about, you know, how much expertise you talked about learning through a grind of doing these backports over the course of a year or more, the actual code base? How much background understanding do you think you really need to contribute meaningfully or review code meaningfully or do other work for these projects?
Yeah, so it really depends on the project. For us, pretty much anyone can do Bitcoin backports and get them merged into our code base. They are, you know, relatively easy. It is hard to mess up. It is easy to review. And so that's a very nice part when it comes to my job of reviewing them, is
right? Basically, I just look at the change that you did on the left half of my screen and the change that Bitcoin did on the right half of my screen. I use a little bit of, you know, common sense of like, is this the right time to merge this or something like that? But, you know, it's very easy to review because Bitcoin already reviewed it. I know that, you know, they have a very high quality of code. Their maintainers know what they're doing. And so if it got approved and merged into Bitcoin, it's probably a good thing to merge. Sometimes we disagree conceptually. There's some stuff like SegWit. Historically, we didn't merge in anything related to SegWit. There's sometimes some conceptual disagreements that we have with their maintainers. But from an actual code perspective, if we agree with what it does, then we like it. So that makes it really easy from a review perspective. It helps kind of build some connections with the person who's kind of making that pull request. So yeah, it's easy to get into. We have, and so Dash Core, well, the Dash Incubator also has a segment of it where if you do contributions to Bitcoin, or not Bitcoin, sorry, if you do contributions to Dash Core, you can get paid out a bounty from the Bitcoin or from the Dash Incubator. And so we have we've had a couple of people over time where they'll do backports for a little while and they'll submit those changes to me. I, you know, review them and eventually merge them in. And then they go to the Dash Incubator and say, okay, here's the contribution I did to Dash Core. And then they get paid out from the Dash Incubator. So you can actually make that like a full-time job if you really kind of wanted to. It takes some effort and time, but yeah, for us, anyone can come and contribute. We're always looking for people who are interested in that, but it really depends on the project. A lot of projects will try to have, you know, good first issue kind of labels on stuff that they want done, and that gives you a good insight of, okay, the maintainer thinks this is valuable, he'll actually merge it in if I do it. But also he thinks it's relatively easy. That doesn't necessarily mean it will be easy, but it's on the easier side of stuff for that project. So definitely look for that. But I do think a lot of these projects, if you reach out to someone in there and say, hey, I want to contribute and work with you guys, they're going to find a way to make it work. That decreases as projects get bigger and bigger, but definitely with smaller projects, they're always looking for people to help out.
And do you see a lot of that effort happening just organically, or is the Dash Incubator a really big part of incentivizing those contributors and
I do think
claim a part of it on there before they start?
Yeah, I do think the Dash Incubator has been really valuable to incentivizing that. Well, at least one of our full-time members of Dash Core now started out as someone who was just kind of working through the Dash Incubator. And so, you know, they would get paid out per pull request. But then over time, you know, we developed a kind of, you know, professional relationship. And he ended up getting a position with Dash Core basically from the contributions that he did independently. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely a good path there. I do think the Dash Incubator has been really valuable in providing a way to get into it with really low commitment and potentially low availability, but still get kind of compensated for it. Yeah.
And when you say that member joined the core dev group, is there a large physical hub that plays a role in that development cycle?
No. So my team, I mean, all of our teams at this point are completely remote and asynchronous. Well, I guess asynchronous is not quite the right word, but we're completely remote. And so, you know, right now I have team members in Europe in different places, in Southeast Asia, in India. There's quite a few kind of team members across the world that contribute and that work for a Dash Core group.
And what's that look like in terms of like org structure?
Do you mean Dash Core group itself or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Dash Core group is relatively flat. It's generally just like two or three levels up to the kind of the highest person, I guess. So Samuel, quantum explorer, is kind of the CTO of Dash Core Group. You can go on dash.org and go, I think, dash.org/team or something like that. And you can see a lot of the members of the organization. So you have the CTO, and then you basically have the team leads under. And so generally speaking, like, I'm in charge of the core dev team. There's Ivan Shumkov, who's basically in charge of the platform team. And then there is a guy named Hash Engineering that is in charge of the mobile teams. And then each of those teams has a couple of different members within those teams that kind of report to that team lead. So we try to keep it relatively flat. Over time, we've had a couple other teams kind of pop up. So we'd rather have more teams, but keep it relatively kind of flat than have giant hierarchies. But that also helps that it's a relatively small organization.
And when you say team leader or being the head of the project, are you planning sort of every single idea and telling everyone what to do? Or is it a more lower level engineering driven development?
Yeah, so it, especially on my team, it is a lot more engineer-driven. And so, you know, our developers, for the most part, know kind of broad tasks that they're working towards. They move towards those without a lot of kind of input necessary from me. So, like, right now, a couple of major projects are, like, backporting BIP 324, which is for P2P encryption, like I think I talked about earlier today. Assume UTXO. And so one of our team members is basically just working towards all of the backports in order to be able to get those features accomplished. And so we do have, like I said, that weekly meeting where we kind of go over and make sure that everyone has stuff to be working on. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm assigning a bunch of tasks for the next week. It's more here's a couple high level tasks maybe that you should be working towards, and then it's up to more or less their judgment on how to actually accomplish that.
Just to follow up on that, I'm curious then, I mean, in your estimation, are there maybe subgroups or like clicks kind of has a negative connotation, but what I'm trying to ask is, are there different subsets of your core team then that, you know, are thinking, oh, well, you're good at this and maybe you guys can do that. And, you know, does that sort of happen or is it a lot of independent action?
So I guess like each team member obviously has some level of a specific specialization, you know, where they are most knowledgeable on a certain part of the code base. But for the most part, it is relatively, you know, anyone could work on any part of the code base. I wouldn't say there are really kind of clicks like that. Yeah, I don't know what good subgroups, what good term to use, but at least for the core dev team, not as much. I think some of the other teams do have, you know, like specific kind of owners of certain parts of the code base or something like that. But we don't really have that.
Well, that's a lot of. Is there anything else you'd want to talk about on the core group side of things? That was a lot of really great information on how that particular model works for as a participant in the whole DAO ecosystem.
Yeah, and that's something that's important to recognize is, you know, DCG, you know, Dash Core Group is kind of the premier group, I guess. It's, you know, the most publicly facing in a lot of ways. It's but, you know, in the past, especially news articles would say like Dash CEO or something like that. And that's just not accurate.
Yeah.
Right. Like Dash does not have a CEO. Dash Core Group doesn't even have a CEO anymore. But, you know, Dash as a whole does not have a chief technical officer. Right. Like Dash Core Group is one of many groups that is funded by the network. And we have an org structure within ourselves. But that does not, you know, expand over into other organizations or anything like that that are funded by the network. So. Yeah.
And as I understand it, when the network does fund the group, it sells that for dollars until it's time to send paychecks out, whereby they buy back Dash and send that to you. What's that like for you? I understand, I heard in another interview that you sort of sell some of it for taxes and hold the rest as Dash. Is that how does that process work for you?
Yeah, so that's going to be different, kind of per team member, generally speaking. Everyone, from my understanding, basically everyone has the option nowadays to either get paid out in Dash or in some fiat currency. It's just kind of the fact of life for most people still that they can't pay for everything with Dash, and so it is valuable to have at least some amount of kind of fiat income. Yeah, it really depends on the team member. There are a number of them that prefer to get paid in Dash and then they'll sell whatever they need to. Other people end up getting, some of the people in the US are W-2 employees now and they get paid in dollars. Yeah, it really just depends on the person. This is something that kind of you can move through with as time as an organization. It's a lot easier to start out, I would say, by just paying in crypto. But for some people in some regulatory environments, that's just not really acceptable. It might be that there is just way too much kind of legwork that needs to be done from a tax perspective in order for, their taxing authority to be happy, and they've decided that it's not worth getting, paid in crypto at this point. But yeah, so it depends.
Well, one of the reasons I bring it up is I understand privacy is really important to a lot of people, and sometimes I might work under a pseudonym. And so when you joined Dash Core, did you need to dox yourself and give them all that tax info?
Yeah, so I mean, anyone working with Dash Core, generally speaking, anyone getting paid by Dash Core, I mean, Dash Core Group is a US company. And as such, Dash Core Group follows all the kind of laws and regulations of the United States. And so, yeah, in order to work for Dash Core as, either a 1099 or W-2 kind of employee, yeah, you would have to provide kind of your name and information. We have a very long-term contributor that has never been paid by Dash Core Group, and Dash Core Group has no idea who he is or anything like that, but he is a very valuable member of the core dev team nonetheless. But he doesn't get paid by us, and so we have no kind of need to know who he is. Yeah, anyone that we pay, we do have to know who we're paying.
Wow, that's really interesting, Pasta. What's that? So I know there's like an upcoming meeting in the Philippines, I think, to try to bring in more developers. Like, what is it like working with those long-term, not compensated contributors? That's really interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, there are some downsides potentially, like A, because we don't pay him, we don't have any leverage over him. And so, he is a very valuable member, but if I want him to do something, it's it, you know it, even though I might be quote unquote in charge of the core dev team in a sense, I can't tell him what to do. I have no real leverage over him. I can ask him if he wants to do something, but so like he doesn't really join some of the kind of meetings that we do, but he's more text-based. Yeah, so yeah, we do have meetups every once in a while. We haven't had one in a little while, but previously we've done kind of a meetup in Thailand or in the country of Georgia, coming up in Vietnam. So yeah, we do try to kind of have meetups and get that kind of, I guess, kind of personal connection and get to know people as well as simply work with them. But it is relatively rare. Takes a while. So
Do people, if they apply to the DAO, they apply to the network to do work? Is there any ever like a small group of people or an individual that does that and makes really great work and does it directly with the masternodes?
yeah, so it's been a little while. I don't so there was a very small team, maybe it was just like one or two developers that was working on a fork of Electrum for Dash, and they were delivering that for a while, and they were funded independently by the DAO. You could look back through the history on Dash Central. So there's also Joel. Joel is basically spearheading the kind of marketing initiatives in a lot of ways. And he also puts in direct proposals to the DAO for compensating for his time, as well as like the actual expense of doing some of this marketing. I think Dash Central itself, its owner, who is just a single guy and single maintainer, I believe he is paid via the DAO as well every once in a while. There are a couple other small projects. I believe there's a contributor who, he's never done any contributions to Dash Core, at least not that I recall, or nothing significant. But he wrote a project called Masternode Zeus, which was basically a relatively simple script to install and manage your Masternode. And I believe he also runs a website like mnowatch.org that basically does some analysis on the voting patterns and what people are voting on, and does analysis on like the percentage of Masternodes on different versions and stuff like that. And I believe he has been paid via the DAO relatively recently. So yeah, there definitely has been a good history of kind of smaller groups, especially now that the fee is a lot lower in order to put in a proposal.
Do you ever feel like you're working for the whole network and they're really determining your salary, or is it more just what the organization itself thinks is important?
Yeah, so that is more on like an organization level. We publish like the total payroll that we do and that kind of thing. And so you could see like an average, because we give obviously like the headcount and the kind of totals, but we generally don't publish like an individual salary or stuff like that. It's generally competitive for the location that you're at, but it is not hyper competitive. You got to keep in mind that it is, you know, remote and everything like that. So it does kind of depend where you're at as to how competitive it might be, but especially really high cost of living areas, like, you know, in very high cost of living areas, you probably are going to get paid less working for Dash Core Group than you could at other opportunities. But yeah.
Wow. And what would a perfect communal working process look like, where everyone sort of has, you know, they get well compensated, they do great work?
Yeah, I mean, can you try to define that question a little bit more for me?
Well, I was trying to wonder, do you like it being a little more centralized and having sort of the rules dictated? Or do you lean more towards just direct voting and get the proposal fee as low as you can and everyone does their own projects?
Yeah, so there's definitely value from like a developer's perspective to not have to manage you know, the governor's proposals directly. Especially for me right now, like if I got in a big fight with Sam, you know, the CTO, I'm sure I could get funding directly from the governance system. I wouldn't be too worried about that. But then I would have to deal with all my own tax setup. I would maybe want to, you know, run everything through an LLC and try to avoid or, you know, minimize any kind of liability from that perspective. There just becomes a lot more overhead when you have your own proposal and you know, need to worry about, okay, I got paid on this date, the price was this much, I sold it 2 days later, I have to report a, you know, net gain of $50 this time. You know, there's a lot more paperwork and everything like that that you need to do. It's very nice to have, you know, someone on the team that is employed to deal with kind of payroll liability and that kind of stuff, and it's out of my hands. I don't have to worry about it.
What do you mean by liability, since everything's, you know, open source licensing?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be very surprised if anyone tried to argue that, like, oh, you created this software and then I lost money or I got scammed and therefore you're liable. But in theory, I guess it could happen. There's kind of a level of disconnect by kind of being employed by a company where, you know, they wouldn't they in theory could have some like standing to sue someone personally, but it would probably get thrown out very quickly. But you would still have to deal with kind of that hassle. Having that company structure between you would, you know, make it not my problem.
Okay. So you're outsourcing a lot of that real world legal risk.
Yeah.
And did they give you dental too?
I think yes. Yes. Benefits are not amazing, but we only have a couple of people based out of the US, so it's hard to kind of, you know, normally you have a big company with like, I don't know, 20 or 30 people in the US, and so you're able to kind of bundle everything together and figure out some good benefits, but when you only have a couple of people really out of the US, it gets a little bit harder to have good benefits, but it's all right.
What do you think, just spitball, and if I threw this at you, you know, everybody on the team just got paid, say it's a stable coin to try to get rid of any other points, and it just gets sent straight to their wallet from the DAO itself every month, and it's agreed upon that they'll get paid straight. Do you think it would be harder for them to set things up logistically?
I mean, a little bit, but probably not a ton. Yeah, I mean, you would have to, you know, remember to put in like the proposal every month and that kind of thing, but it's relatively, I mean, you can put in a recurring proposal for up to like, I don't know, 6 to 12 months. So, yeah, most of the kind of stuff is just in like taxes and having all of the paperwork for that kind of stuff. Yeah. It's a lot easier when you kind of just get a W-2 and you know exactly what you need to pay on rather than 1099 plus dealing with all the capital gains from, you know, getting it one day and having to sell it a couple of days later partial or that kind of thing.
But would you still be doing the same work?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you got, say, Dash Network paid you, I don't know, 10 grand a month. Would you, and you could do whatever you want, you know, would you still be doing all the same things?
Yeah, probably.
Well, that's really interesting. I'll leave it to the community if anyone else wants to come in and ask some closing questions here. Thank you for sharing your insights, Pasta. I had one instance that happened that was interesting because we were dealing with a similar thing on how to make a UI choice that had sort of compliance implications when CoinJoin was rebranded from Coin Merger. You're going to have to correct me. I might have the word wrong there. But the name changed, and the button moved a little bit further away on the standard UI. And I remember an interview you talked about it. It wasn't like a huge decision on your part. Are there any like compliance sides of things, especially around with the mixers or Have you had any pushback or any choices like that could have legal implications? And then what's sort of your thought process for how to make a choice on something that has a lot of nuance to it, like the moving of certain compliance items like that?
Yeah, so the biggest concern around that time was primarily around exchanges in certain jurisdictions delisting Dash, and that was really frustrating to the the CEO at the time and some other members of the team. And the reason it was really frustrating is from a technical perspective, everything that you do on Dash from like a privacy point of view, you can do exactly the same on Bitcoin. And so we had, you know, tried to reach out to these regulators and show them, hey, here is the exact same thing on Bitcoin. Here is like the exact same CoinJoin. Like you cannot distinguish these two besides the fact of the address type. And so honestly, I don't think it worked, but we wanted to kind of debrand some of these we called it Private Send at the time. We wanted to debrand it to just make it clear that this is CoinJoin. This is the same technology that is built into Bitcoin that is accessible on every UTXO-based system. There's really nothing special about the way that Dash does it, except it makes it easier for a normal user to do it. There's nothing special from a technological standpoint. And so, like I said, I don't really think it worked, but the goal was to kind of minimize the perception of it being unique and different, at least from a regulator's perspective. From my perspective at the time, I didn't really care about debranding it or not, because it doesn't change the actual technical features of it. It doesn't remove it. It didn't remove anything. It, I guess, made it like... So another thing that happened with that is we basically created a dedicated tab for sending with CoinJoin mixed funds. And one of the benefits of that is every once in a while someone would, you know, try to send with CoinJoin funds and they would forget to check the button, and they would send with, you know, normal funds, and that could be problematic depending on what you're trying to do. And so we wanted to kind of separate that and make it very obvious that, okay, right now you're using CoinJoin funds, right now you're not. We definitely want to make sure that we are, you know, providing valuable features, and kind of, you know, privacy is really important. We're never going to do anything that strips kind of privacy or the ability to do CoinJoin or anything like that out of Dash Core, out of Dash. But we do want to make sure, we did at the time especially want to kind of try it out and see if debranding it would potentially make regulators a little less scared. Because that's what we ended up finding. I was never in any of these meetings. I didn't deal with any of this. But the CEO at the time would go to a lot of these meetings and say, okay, here's the deal. It's the exact same. And then the regulator would look at them and say, but it says private send. That means it's special. And we didn't really know how to deal with that besides say, okay, I guess we can call it CoinJoin like everyone else does. Yeah. Over time, I think we've seen that that hasn't really done much from a regulator perspective. They still haven't really changed their tune, because now they just say, but I Google what's a privacy coin and it says Dash. Therefore you get banned. It's frustrating kind of dealing with regulators sometimes, but thankfully that's not a part of my job. I don't really do that. We just ship code that people can run.
Could you tell us a little more about when making that those transactions private has a really great benefit for the users?
Anytime that you don't want someone to potentially be able to see how much money you have, how, you know, where your funds came from, you know, if you are, you know, working at a strip club on Saturday and going to and donating your tithe on Sunday, you might not want your pastor seeing where those funds came from. I don't know. Any reason why, you know, you wouldn't, you know, that's a thing to keep in mind in blockchain, is it's not like a credit card. Anyone can look at where these funds came from.
Yeah.
And so using something like CoinJoin allows you to kind of break that chain. And you can't trivially see where those funds came from anymore. You just know that they are good funds. Yeah. We definitely think that privacy is a very important component of any cryptocurrency system. If you can't send money and not worry about your privacy, then it's not going to be usable, right? Like Dash stands for digital cash, right? That's what its goal is. Its goal is to be, you know, fungible, quick, easy to send, easy to use. And if I give you a $20 bill, you don't know where it came from. You know, it's not like it's stamped. These are all of the places it's been before. You know, no one would want that in a currency. And so that's why we give that ability to users.
So how do you, would you reconcile that with username identifiers? Like if I have a pasta.dash, and I don't know the technicals,
there's a lot there. So that's a really interesting question. That's part of Dash Platform, actually. Part of Dash Platform is implementing systems that the wallets can use to allow people to create usernames on Dash. And the way that it's done basically behind the scenes is it's very similar to a stealth address, which sounds scary, but it's really not. And it's actually not a stealth address behind the scenes, but it works kind of similarly. Basically, you create a contact request, and those contact requests are public, but once you accept a contact request with someone else, everything else between you two is more or less not kind of visible from, like, it's not linkable between blockchain and usernames. You can see that, okay, something happened on the blockchain where one person sent to another, but you can't link those addresses back to a username. And so once you establish a contact with someone, you'll be able to send and receive money really easily. And someone on the blockchain wouldn't be able to see that, oh, this is, you know, John paying Pasta. They would just see this is one person paying another.
So it's sort of like a public key Diffie-Hellman?
Yeah. So really, I think what it is so when you... And I'm not really a platform team, so I can't speak to this as well. But my understanding is basically when you create an identity, you're basically publishing a public key on the blockchain. And then later on, when someone wants to create a friend request with you, they will basically create a derivation in their wallet, and they'll create an extended public key to that derivation. And then they'll send you that encrypted extended public key. And then they're able to decrypt it. They'll send you one back, and then you're able to send each other funds as many times as you want. You know, they should never, you know, kind of be linked to each other. And it's not really Diffie-Hellman. It's just encrypting, an extended public key that is specific for them.
Okay. And are you at risk if the base public key gets exposed?
I mean, I guess I don't know what you mean. I guess if you do like leak your extended public key, like, yeah, you'd be able to see all the transactions that are related to it. Yeah, that is like potentially where something like stealth addresses actually could make some value. The problem with stealth addresses, generally speaking, is it's very hard to make them light client compatible. From my understanding, generally with stealth addresses, you have to look at every single transaction and check, is this transaction for me? You can't use like a Bloom filter or anything like that to just get transactions that you're interested in. And as a result, you can't really create mobile clients with stealth addresses, at least not easily. There might be some new math and new crypto around that that I'm not super well versed in yet, but yeah, using encrypted XPubs should work just as well for that. Because really, you know, even if you use stealth addresses, if the person that is sending you money leaked it, they could leak other stuff, and the same could apply to like stealth addresses.
Right. Like I said, I'll leave it back to the community if anyone has any last questions. The only reason I ask is because, you know, a lot of newer users are sort of used to having that bank account model. And if, as we look at these like cool zero knowledge or these crypto proofs or the layer two, the interesting scalings, you know, one thing I heard you say previously is payments are most efficient on a UTXO model. And so I just wanted to hear a little bit more on sort of what you thought on that side of things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, account models end up just kind of requiring additional overhead. I do believe, I mean, platform is a kind of account model if you want to look at it from that perspective. But Dash platform is more of a data kind of data storage makes it sound like the wrong thing. It makes it seem like more of like a Filecoin type setup. It's not really arbitrary data storage, but it's more like a database type system. Account-based models do have very good use cases, but for general payments, UTXOs give you better privacy. It gives you better performance generally. Yeah.
It was really excellent to hear so much of the perspective that you've had being in this core role in you know, a pioneer and emergent key player, kind of as a whole bunch of communities. I mean, there are hundreds or thousands now of these of DAOs that, you know, communities that want to build some project at scale, that want to engage with a group of motivated individuals, that want to inspire, but don't want to have the shackles of the centralized control, because ultimately, you know, it's difficult to find people that are doing things out of, you know, like your core team member who's maintained anonymity through their desire to not take a paycheck. You know, that kind of passion is really far apart, hard to find. And of course, that kind of, if we call it economic privilege or freedom, hard to find. And to find them together, ooh, even tougher. So I think that's, that in my mind, at least, part of my fascination with these, with this kind of structure, governance, and organizational metric is that we can try to make things more accessible. People can contribute what they're comfortable to contribute, when they're comfortable to contribute it, and rest assured knowing that, you know, a diverse collective of like-minded individuals and shared passions are going to push forwards for whatever the best realization is of that thing. So we're burgeoning ourselves, looking forward to bring forward our own advocacy and custody platforms. And it's just, again, so nice to be able to speak with you. And it's so great you took the time today to do it, especially, as you mentioned, doing such a busy week for you with these pending launches on the 29th. So just thanks so much again for that.
Yeah, no worries. It was a good break from everything else I've been working on.
Well, good.
Too many weekend Git commits, Pasta.
He's on that Wednesday to Sunday schedule.
Yeah. I mean, that is one of the huge benefits of this kind of, more asynchronous work, is you can kind of work whenever you're motivated, and you're able to create your more flexible schedule. It's interesting. Sometimes I feel like, gosh, I'm really not doing enough. And then I have weeks like this where I'm, you know, incredibly, incredibly productive and getting a bunch of stuff done. It ebbs and flows. And it's good to kind of recognize that and push yourself to do better when it is at a low point, but also recognize that it's okay too.
Yeah, with you 100% on that. Pat on the back.
Yeah, seriously. Thanks. Do you feel like because of that you have control over, I guess, your working life, but also your financial income and your collective life?
I am like salaried. I don't really have a huge disparity. Like, there's no disparity depending on how many kind of hours I really work. It's more about I need to get everything done that I need to get done. And so definitely from like a personal perspective, it's very valuable to be able to recognize like, okay, I'm not being productive right now. I'm gonna, you know, I don't have to stay here for the next, you know, until it's 5 p.m. I can go do something else and get my brain off of this until I'm gonna be in a better spot to be productive and accomplish this. So, you know, there's some days where, you know, the wife goes to bed and it's, you know, 8, 9 p.m. and I stay up and I work for a couple extra hours because I'm moving towards a PR that I want to get up, and I feel real motivated at that time. And then there's other times where, that doesn't work out. So, yeah, being able to have that flexibility, and you're much more productive when you are motivated, and that's quite valuable.
Will you ever use that time to work on community derivatives like STdash or RenDash?
I've never worked on any of those kind of projects. Generally, I find that for the most part, to me, programming is programming. And so I try to keep most of my programming to kind of Dash stuff, just because that's kind of I feel like I only have so much kind of so many programming hours in a week, I guess, that I can get myself motivated for. Mm-hmm. And so I'll try to do something else. I'll find something else to be doing, and whether that's kind of volunteering or anything like that, and having some other stuff going on. But I generally try not to do a bunch of other software engineering related stuff.
Oh, well, that's incredible. And again, what an inspirational story. Really coming from the grassroots and learning it yourself, getting the experience, and just building a career. Really incredible pasta. Really, thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, if anyone has any further questions, you can always reach out to me on Keybase at keybase.io/pasta, or I guess here on X, although I don't really look at it much, as well as my email is pasta@dash.org or on the Dash Discord. So, yeah.
Excellent. All right. Well, if any, we do have a couple of live listeners here, if anyone does have a quick question. Otherwise, you know, thanks so much for sharing your contacts. One of us was about to ask. And
yeah.
And once, you know, maybe some months down the line, you know, when we have more of a structure in place. Because you know, right? It's such an exploratory moment right now, and we're so happy to reap the benefits of the, you know, of you know the Lewis and the Clarks and the Pastas that have expanded so far out west to really understand some of. Oh wait, I got another. We're gonna copy the Pastas and. not directly. I just mean that you know your learning experiences are ours, and it's so great to have access to that.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff to learn about, especially around like supply chain security, around reproducible builds, about making sure that, you know, the binaries that you are providing people are provable to be from the source code that you are saying it's from. You know, open source is great, but if people are just downloading and running binaries, then you need to have a way for them to actually validate themselves that those binaries are correct. Yeah.
Preaching the truth, Pasta, as always. Thanks so much for sharing, and definitely everyone go and learn more on what he's working on.
Thanks again. Have a great night, and you know, we'll catch you another time.
Alrighty, cool. See you guys later.